Welcome you all to the courtroom. We have students with court with class present. They are from Edgar High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Court with Class is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The students across the state are invited to attend an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, then not only do they appear for oral argument, but they are given the briefs of the case we are about to hear, and they may do some extra activities within their classes about the case. The court also appoints each day a justice who will meet with the classes who attend at noon after the second case, and the justice and the students discuss the procedures of the court. They do not discuss the substance of the case. We're very proud of this program, and thousands of students have attended Court with Class. It's part of a general program of the court of outreach to not only students but to teachers through our Teachers Institute. If anyone here wants a summary of the case we are about to hear, the marshal has one, and you may raise your hand and she will give you a summary. Would you raise your hand now if you need that? Fine. All right. I mentioned the Teachers Institute. Their teacher from Edgar was part of our Teachers Institute, and I gather he's here today. It's good seeing you again, and thank you for bringing your class, and thank you for attending the Institute. With that said, I would like to now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. He is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Having said that and made the appropriate introductions, we are now going to hear 04AP2057D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Randy J. Netzer. Representing Randy J. Netzer is he is appearing by himself, and he has 25 minutes, and then has rebuttal. Mr. Netzer.
May it please the court, I'm Attorney Randy J. Netzer. I'd like to thank each of you, members of the court, for allowing me to make this presentation today. It was 21 and a half years ago when I first came to this room and took the oath as a member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and that's one of the proudest moments of my life. I could think of nothing more fulfilling than to be a good lawyer, than to be a good father, husband. I want to impress upon you the fact that above and beyond all else, especially given the discussion that this case involves, women are an important part of my life. Women are people that I respect, and every woman that I see, I think of her as in the image of my mother or my grandmother or my niece or the daughter that I thought I'd have someday. With that said, this case is about allegations of ethics violations that involve a claim by the Office of Lawyer Regulation that there's violation of Supreme Court Rule 20, subparagraph 8, subparagraph 4, And so I imagine that's as good a starting point as any. It reads with that section that would be professional misconduct to commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. With that having been said, it is true that in August of 2001, an Alford plea was entered for stalking and for harassment. And so that is what is at issue. Do those crimes arise to the level of violating 20.8.4? And I think that has been analyzed most in depth by the district committee that was first empowered by the Office of Lawyer Regulation to review the case. Attorney Jim Curtis reviewed that matter, and subsequent to that, his recommendation was that it did not rise to the level of a violation, but the Office of Lawyer Regulation pursued it. Despite that recommendation, as the court may or may not be aware, obviously there's a lot of history involved with this case. Some things that you may think of as relevant, others that you may not. Obviously that decision is in your hands. I think that the entire scope of what surrounds us is relevant. So I apologize, cutting me off if I'm saying too much about one area, and then we'll go on to another because there's a number of different issues. First of all, focusing on this particular case, there was a relationship, to give you a little bit of history, there was a relationship between me and an individual that worked at the La Crosse County Circuit Court's office. I have been practicing law since 1984, and I have regularly used the La Crosse County Courthouse, and that's how we came to meet. I had been using those facilities for nearly 15 years before this lady started working there. And after we broke up, I continued to use those facilities. At a point subsequent to that, there was a restraining order. I did not attend the restraining order hearing. My philosophy about that was that I felt that if she felt more secure having a restraining order, then I'd be happy with that. I did not believe that there was a basis for a restraining order. When I think of a restraining order, sometimes I think of very pejorative types of things, very explosive types of ideas. When someone mentions harassment or stalking, I think of someone that is terrorizing someone else, and that just is not acceptable. I think of sometimes even violence is involved. When I hear that somebody has an injunction against them or a restraining order against them, I think there must have been some violence. There is no violence in my past. There is no violence in this particular case. There's no property damage. There's allegations of repeated phone calls, following, all those things, to me, still are serious issues. But as based upon the Alford plea, you can no doubt realize that I've protested all those elements since the very beginning. After the restraining order was issued in September of 1990, I believe there was an injunction that was subsequently issued. Since I didn't go to the restraining hearing, I didn't get the injunction initially. It was, to me, not a major issue because I had no intention on having any contact with the other party, so I wasn't going to violate the injunction. I think that the strongest argument that the Office of Lawyer Regulation would have in arguing their case is that I would have violated the injunction, because to me, that's sacred. That's the only, of course, if you're injuring somebody, hurting somebody, you know, that's about the worst thing you could do. But right beneath that is if you're going to violate court rules, because especially as somebody that's an officer of the court, if you don't take that seriously, then you don't deserve being a lawyer. How can you be a lawyer if you don't take court orders seriously? So it's my contention that I never violated the injunction. I continued doing the same sorts of things that I was. I tried to do them as every chance I could when there would be little or no opportunity to have any proximity to the other party. And so even after I didn't get the injunction until after I was charged and another week had passed by, and I still think that the injunction itself does not specifically say that I could not go to the courthouse to do my work. With respect to that, after the injunction was issued, after I was charged, the court let me back to use those same facilities to do what I had been doing before. So plus the fact that the implication that I got from when I was served with the original temporary restraining order, it was in the courthouse. The sheriff that served me with the restraining order did not tell me to leave the courthouse. He let me continue to do my work. And so I was always under the impression that as long as I'm doing what I'm doing, I'm not having contact with this person. She worked on a different floor. She didn't work on the same floor that I did my work and so forth, that I wasn't violating any rules. So I swear to you that I never intentionally violated any injunctions at all.
Was that the only injunction you ever had?
That I ever had.
By restraining order on you personally?
No, there's a history there. And talking about the scope of things, if you want to broaden it, I can certainly talk about the entire scope. There's a restraining order by my first girlfriend, Cheryl Peterson. There was a restraining order with Carol Hansen. And there was a restraining order with Patricia Karpinski.
But you weren't charged with violating any of those. Is that right? Or were you?
I did send flowers. The simple answer is no, I was charged with violating one of those. I sent Carol Hansen some flowers after a restraining order. That was an error in judgment. It wasn't my intent to violate the injunction, but if I would have been thinking more with my mind, then I would have probably realized that it was not just not legally correct, but not appropriate, you know, in the long run, I guess I learned a lesson from that. Those charges were dismissed, but still it's hurtful to me to think about that. But on the other hand, it's somewhat, it's hurtful for me more, not from a personal standpoint, but from a standpoint that I sent this lady flowers and I realized after the fact that I shouldn't have, and I realized too late that this might be sending the wrong signal to her. And that's what hurts me the most, is that, and I'm very saddened by the fact that, you know, that I had to go through that to come to that realization instead of would have thought through it first. It's no excuse. At the time, maybe I was trying to be too romantic and not thinking that process through thoroughly. But
Mr. Netzer, you've had no prior discipline. Is that right? For the OLR?
No, Your Honor.
For the state's lawyer discipline. You've had no prior discipline.
None, Your Honor.
And you self-reported.
Yes, Your Honor.
All to your credit. And
well, I self-reported because I do believe that it's serious. I do realize that the law does, even if not for the law, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but even though the law says that, you know, there, if there's a criminal charge, that there's a presumption and that sort of thing, I self-reported because, I thought it was the right thing to do. I mean, as corny as that sounds, in the previous instances, I didn't think that there was any merit to this. I even wrote, I think, in my answer to the Office of Lawyer Regulation that the self-reporting did not occur, I admit, immediately when I was charged. There was a little delay because I had thought that I could explain to the district attorney and the court officials what was taking place, and then I realized that they saw things different than I did. So I thought that, well, it's something that I need to let the Office of Lawyer Regulation know, and that's my obligation. So,
well, I think it is to your credit. What I'm trying to do is try and put in and have you put in elements that are to your credit. So the fact you've had no prior discipline is to your credit, and that you self-reported is to your credit. And I understand you're not actively engaged in the active practice of law at the moment. Is that right?
I would say yes and no. I know in the law everything should be a yes or a no, not a yes and no. I apologize.
You're not on
I'm not on staff. I don't work for anybody else. I do practice law on an occasional basis, so I will go in front of a judge or that sort of thing. It's rather rare. I don't practice partly because it's not my element. I mean, I got involved with the law because I wanted to help people. So I pick and choose the spots when I practice law. All the law that I practice is pro bono. I do whatever I do for free. And I base it on a cause. You know, some of the biggest causes that I wish, and to be honest with you, I'm not as involved with that as I'd want to be, are as much as I'm for women, I have a pro-life interest, and I'm pro-adoption, and those are the things that I like to advocate, and I anticipate doing more of that. In fact, just kind of going to the side a little bit from the main of what we're talking about, my long-term goal, even though I have that capability of practicing law, and I still do it from time to time, I was hoping to clear my name of these charges because my long-term goal is there is a program with Notre Dame University called the ACE program, Alliance for Catholic Education, where you give up your time, you donate your knowledge, your experience. You work in a southern low-income community, helping people, serving as an educator, and that's kind of my 5-year goal is to get involved with that program. And I thought that having this type of record is not going to help that. But either way, I still intend on following through on that.
Well, that's the next thing I was going to raise with you, Mr. Netzer. The discipline here is suggested as a private reprimand. Pardon me?
They're private.
Well, that's the problem. That's the problem of appealing on a private reprimand. And you obviously understood that and understand it now.
Right.
And other than no discipline or a cautionary letter, it's the lowest form of discipline. And I don't have any idea whether ACE or any other program would require you to not only reveal it, but also how they would view it. So my ultimate question to you is, why appeal a private reprimand?
Well, this has really been my one chance to take this matter in front of a judge and have someone hear me. I felt that at the trial court level, that under 60.013, that Judge Gonzalez should have recused herself based on the lack of partiality, that given the fact that it's pretty clear, I think, in that rule, that in that Supreme Court rule, that the appearance of impartiality is roughly the equivalent of defines impartiality. And given the fact that the employee was a La Crosse County employee and had a relationship with the judge, the same can be said of the district attorney, because there was a companion case to this where I was accused of following, I suppose, the victim to Pizza Doctors, a local pizza place, and nothing could be further from the truth. I happened to be at the same place, but what do you do when you're at the same place with somebody else? I didn't know she was there. I did not follow her to that place, and I certainly didn't have contact with her. That matter was dismissed, but before it was dismissed, we went through the trial process and so forth. It never actually got to trial before it was dismissed. But what happened was, in that instance, a Monroe County judge was used, I believe a Monroe County or a Jackson County district attorney was used, and I think that complies with Section 978.045(1)(r), subparagraph H of the Wisconsin statutes, that says that when there's a conflict of interest with district attorneys, given the fact that for a time this victim worked in the district attorney's office, it makes sense that the case should have been handled by other people instead of the district attorney itself. At the time that the Alford plea was filed, I had all kinds of issues about the viability of the conviction. I know I've had my day in court, as so to speak. I've taken the matter from the trial court to the Court of Appeals, from the Court of Appeals, the Wisconsin Supreme Court denied reviewing it, and then I took it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I still intend on pursuing Rule 22 of the U.S. Supreme Court rules to make application to have them revisit my case. And there's a number of different issues involved. And you know, one of the things that is concerning to me about all this is that it's going to sound like I'm somebody that has no regrets or remorse for what has happened. You know, if the victim had one moment where she felt insecure or whatever, you know, I feel bad about that. But I know that I wasn't in proximity to her. I know that I wasn't making the phone calls to her. And as you've pointed out, there's been these same sorts of things that have happened in the past. And I've got a police record from Greendale where this lady that accused me of making repeated phone calls to her, they did traces and so forth, and they found that the phone number that was traced to that where she was getting all these phone calls was not my phone number.
Was that case this one that were that's before us?
No, it's kind of that was what that earlier case where I sent the girl flowers.
In this Ilford plea, I just wanted to in the record I saw you were represented by counsel.
Yes.
And so your concern here was that it was ineffective counsel for you?
Yes, that was one of the issues that I rose at the Court of Appeals and all the way up through the U.S. Supreme Court. What happened, and it goes, if I may, it goes even before that. Before we got to the issue of ineffective counsel, there was the issue of, lack of counsel. It's escaping me the term that I want to use now, the legal term. But Powell versus Alabama says that, you know, you're entitled to have representation. And there's a whole line of cases that say it's constitutional that everyone has a right to a lawyer. And initially I was going to represent myself. I had filed a multi-page motion to dismiss where I addressed all the issues. Later on, this attorney that I did hire, he said that, oh, you shouldn't have done that. You're giving away too many facts to the other side. That's not the way that I operate. I'm honest about things. You know, within my motion to dismiss, I don't care if they think that, you know, this is legally what you should do or you shouldn't do. It's more important to me that I'm factual, that I'm correct, that I'm accurate, that I'm telling people the truth. And so, you know, he complained to me about that, but, you know, I have no regrets about filing my motion to dismiss.
Mr. Netzer, what is it that you want the court to do here?
Your Honor, under 20.8.4 of the Supreme Court rules, I would like the Supreme Court to look over that carefully and realize that it says, commit a crime that reflects adversely on the honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. In this particular case, my argument is that it doesn't affect, the crime involved does not affect adversely on my honesty because I've been honest throughout the process. It does not affect my trustworthiness because they let me back into the courthouse after this happened, and I never had any contact with this person after, you know, and that's the same as it was before. It's just that, you know, they saw me go into the courthouse, and they used that as a basis for an allegation of violation of the restraining order, even though in the injunction itself it doesn't say that I'm prohibited from using the courthouse. It says that I'm prohibited from going to her place of employment. So I never went up to the second floor where her offices were. I always came down to the first floor and did my work, and then I left. And then also my fitness to practice law as an attorney, I don't think that it affects my fitness. This was well investigated, I believe, by the district committee's office. And the district committee came to the conclusion that this particular case did not warrant a violation of 20.8.4. So I understand the court may disagree with my belief, with the belief of the district committee, but I don't believe that the Office of Law and Regulation has done any investigation above and beyond what the district committee had already done. And I think that their conclusion is based as much on the fact that when you talk about these crimes in their shorthand terms, stalking and harassment, that's very explosive types of terms that have a stereotype. And I think that's what the basis is of the charges. So in answer to your question, I would like you to just dismiss the OLR's complaint. But again, with respect to, I guess it's very important to me, with respect to the failure to have counsel, I was going to represent myself. I went through that process. I realized that it wasn't going to work, and I was very depressed, so I tried killing myself. You know, I took a helium canister. I read the book Final Exit in the library one day to learn how to do it. And I went into my garage. I had closed all the vents and everything. You know, I went up to the roof and made sure that all the vents were closed. And my mom is here today, so I apologize. She shouldn't have to hear this sort of stuff, but... you know, I sat in the car with the car running and the canister of helium opened up and the mask over my head and everything. And, you know, I thought, well, no one's listening to me. I'm gonna do this. So when I made it past that, you know, I just couldn't do it. You know, either I'm not brave enough, not smart enough, not courageous enough. I'd like to think that what saved me at that moment was the idea that, well, maybe there's some other way that I can help others. You know, maybe there's some other way that I can make some meaning out of my life. And so I just couldn't go through with that process. And when I came out of that, I started looking for an attorney to represent me. I didn't feel I could do it myself anymore. And I asked for a continuance. What did the court do? The court did not grant me a continuance, but a few days later when the district attorney wanted a continuance, the court granted that continuance. Then when I had went to, if I may, I went to every attorney that I could find in the local phone book that is a criminal lawyer. I talked to some of these people on the phone, like Michael Devaney, Kenneth Peterson, Mr. Huseman, Mr. Guth, and Margaret Ani, Ann Brando, Tara Burgos, Cheryl Gill, Dorothy Strausheim, Kimberly Henderson, and on down the list. I talked to those people to see if I could get appointments to get in for an interview.
Counsel, I want to pull you back to your argument that you were earlier making to make sure that I understand it.
Okay.
And I think your argument is essentially this, that when you look at the provision that OLR is using, that is, that it's misconduct if you commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on your honesty. You're saying, look, I'm honest, maybe even honest to a fault, that I'm trustworthy, and you've given examples, and you think that although stalking and violating a court order on its face sounds to be awful conduct. You know, you can't violate a court order. But if you look at some of the underlying circumstances, that it really doesn't affect your fitness as a lawyer. Now, that's really what your argument is. Is that correct, or in large part?
Well, I'm begging the court to look beneath those names that are attached to those charges and focus on my particular case, yes.
Okay. Mr. Netzer?
Yes.
Your red light's on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's perfectly all right. And you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, may it please the Court and Mr. Netzer. My name is Bill Weigel. I'm here on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. We're here because Mr. Netzer appealed from the report of referee David Friedman and because he requested oral argument. Excuse me. My intent this morning is to really discuss two, maybe three appellate issues. I'll refrain on a number of others unless asked because I would respectfully submit that the case law, Supreme Court rules, and common sense would dictate that a number of issues raised by Mr. Netzer in his briefing be resolved favorably to OLR and that each of those was adequately addressed in OLR's brief. What I would like to address are first, the validity of Mr. Netzer's criminal convictions, and secondly, his violation of SCR 20:8.4 sub B, and that your referee's findings in that regard are not clearly erroneous, and that your referee's conclusion that Mr. Netzer's criminal conduct violated that rule is sound and is grounded in the record of this case. You know, we know that the case is brought upon an attorney having been convicted of two crimes. And the record before the referee and the record before you contains conclusive evidence of his commission of those crimes. And that conclusive evidence, pursuant to your rule, 22 sub 20 sub 5, is a certified copy of the judgment of conviction of the two crimes of which Mr. Netzer was convicted. And that is conclusive evidence is recited by rule and in prior case law. And that is not a new rule. That rule, with regard to the submission and admission into evidence of a judgment of conviction being conclusive evidence of an attorney having committed the crimes for which he's convicted, well, it's been around since before the SCRs were controlling attorney conduct and since before I was in high school. And in some ways, as to the first issue, I mean, that's it. The disciplinary proceeding, the purpose of this proceeding is not to relitigate Mr. Netzer's guilt. His guilt is what it is, and it's been conclusively established in this proceeding. And the convictions are not subject to collateral attack in this proceeding.
Well, but you know, convictions of particular crimes can be committed in a variety of ways, right? I mean, there are a variety of fact circumstances, all of which will result in a conviction.
Yes.
And accepting, for the moment, the conviction, which he was convicted, did have appeal rights, which were used and lost. That is, ultimately, the convictions were affirmed. Won't it matter under the facts of the circumstances of the case of the conviction whether or not that conviction undermines trustworthiness and honesty?
That would be the second prong, I guess, of what I would like to discuss. And as Justice Bradley asked Mr. Netzer, isn't that the crux of the matter here as to whether the conduct, the criminal conduct, is violative of 8.4b, and that would implicate honesty and trustworthiness and fitness in other respects. Yes, that's where I'm going with this.
Right, so we've agreed there's been a conviction, or convictions, right?
Right.
Can't change those facts.
Well, you can't change those facts, but Mr. Netzer, and I don't mean disrespect toward him by characterizing it this way, but I think I'm parroting language of the referee, but is obsessively and repeatedly in each and every forum available to him challenging those facts. And that is a large part of his, at least, briefing presentation, and I believe was a large part of his hearing presentation and a large part of his presentation to the various reviewing courts. And so I guess what I'd want to emphasize is just, yes, that you can't change those convictions, and not only because I can assert some rule, your rule, that says that it's conclusive evidence, but because really, if you take a step back and ask that wider question, was it fair? Is it fair to do this? It is because he has sought review. and the decision, the convictions were reviewed by Judge Gonzalez, by the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals decision is an exhibit in this proceeding, one of Mr. Netzer's exhibits. By this court, by not accepting his petition for review, actually dismissing a premature one and then looking at the matter and not accepting it, and by the U.S. Supreme Court. And he asked for a rehearing before the U.S. Supreme Court, and that was likewise denied. And so not only is it required by rule, Chief, but I would submit it's fair and it's appropriate that we get to the point of saying the conduct is as the conduct was alleged in the criminal proceeding. Now does it violate 8.4B?
And now, what did the district committee say?
The district committee and that report is in evidence in this proceeding. At Respondents Exhibit 1, agreed that it was there were criminal convictions, certainly. There were some ongoing criminal matters. There were really three criminal charges, and these convictions arose out of the first one, the 00 case number. And by the way, and I'll address your question, but the complaint upon which these two convictions were based is likewise in evidence at OLR Exhibit 10, I believe. The complaint with the 00 case number. District committee looked at it and, you know, they began to exercise their judgment and they worked in, I think, a standard that is inapplicable to the analysis they should have made, and they looked at a summary suspension case. And as the court is unfortunately aware from a number of those recently passed and pending, summary suspension talks about a serious crime, a felony, or a serious crime that impacts upon an attorney's fitness to practice. And it seems that the sole district committee investigator utilized that standard and wrote a report saying, well, you know, I don't think this rises to the level of that type of a serious crime where we should find 8.4B. And that's really a mixed rationale, a mixed analysis. It is not controlling. It is something that I would point out, Chief, and members of the court, was certainly considered by OLR because the district committee report is submitted to the supervising OLR investigator. You know, it doesn't trump the OLR investigator. It doesn't trump the OLR director. It doesn't trump your referee, nor the PRC, which determined and gave cause to proceed to file these charges. It's a piece of the puzzle, and it's a piece of the puzzle that the referee specifically in his report said, I've looked at this report of the district committee. I have considered it. I know that they are recommending that there is not an 8.4B violation here, and I'm paraphrasing, but I, the referee, have looked at this matter. I've heard from Mr. Netzer at the disciplinary hearing. I've examined all of OLR's exhibits. I've examined Mr. Netzer's exhibits, and on the totality of the record, I am making specific findings, and those findings support the conclusion that I'm going to draw, and that's that Mr. Netzer's conduct did indeed violate 8.4B.
Mr. Weigel, if I could, I want to focus in on some of those findings. I know you've got them on page 18, I believe, of your brief. One of the findings is that Mr. Netzer was not being able to honestly evaluate his situation, but that reflects on his ability to be honest with others. I think that went to the honesty point. And I guess when I think in terms of honesty, usually that connotes some knowing or knowledge of false statements or something along those lines. And I'm wondering whether or not the referee's findings here accurately reflect, at least with respect to the honesty portion, the violation of the rule.
Well, I believe that they do, and I want to remind you, Justice Butler, as you know, that 8.4B is written in the disjunctive, honesty or trustworthiness, adversely reflects.
I want to come back to that, but I want to start here.
Okay. Or in other respects, which is, of course, a catch-all. Well, you know, the referee found that his actions, of intentional actions, that he should know, as the circuit court found, would reasonably cause Ms. Nelton to be placed in fear, that those can't be viewed as conduct that's honest. Not being able, as you said, to honestly evaluate his situation reflects on his ability to be honest. I think that honesty is probably one of the weaker links in that three-pronged analysis because, and again, I've met Mr. Netzer this morning. He's presents with a gentle and sincere affect, so I don't mean him disrespect, but I and I'm not in medical training. So with all those disclaimers, can a person who is somewhat perhaps delusional or taking an obsessive track on the matters be dishonest if they don't know? I would submit that whether he is unwilling and acting intentionally or whether he is unable and not acting intentionally, the referee found through the totality of the record that he's simply not being honest with himself, with others about the situation that he found himself in. He told you, well, you know, the reason, in his brief, he said, the reason I entered a criminal plea was because OLR didn't follow up on this unsigned intake letter, and it had been a few days past that deadline.
I guess I understand, well, at least arguably, why that might go towards one's fitness. If one can't really grasp the situation and one is representing others. But I'm not sure that it goes towards honesty if there's any lack of dishonest or any dishonest intent present. That's the concern that I have.
I can understand that concern, and it certainly has merit, and I would just ask you to look at the referee's findings are not just recited on page, you said 18, I believe, of OLR's brief, but I believe they're recited earlier in the brief around pages 06 and 07. And in some of those, findings, I believe, it says Netzer is deceiving himself when he believes that the women find nothing wrong with his obsessive relationships. That's in the referee's report. There are findings, none of which have been found or are going to be found to be clearly erroneous, that support the conclusion as to honesty. But yeah, that's the weak prong of that three-part test.
But Counselor, the kinds of facts you're relying on, that he may not understand the effect of his actions on the women with whom he'd had relationships, those kind of activities could occur without any type of a criminal conviction. So if that were the standard for honesty, he could violate the rule even without the criminal conviction, but the section of the rules he's charged with violating requires a criminal conviction. So I have a little trouble equating that with the type of honesty that is at issue here.
It doesn't require a criminal conviction. I believe it requires criminal conduct or activity. And there have been cases in which an attorney has engaged in conduct thought to be in which OLR or BAPR then proved
to
be criminal.
Correct.
Yeah. And I'd prefer to focus also on the trustworthiness and the fitness in other respects, because I believe in those realms, Mr. Nett, the adverse reflection upon the profession is much more clear. I mean, trustworthiness, we're talking about an attorney's criminal breach of a trust of a relationship. And that reflects adversely on an attorney's trustworthiness. An attorney's violation of a court order directed to him about his activity, reflects adversely on his trustworthiness and reflects adversely on his fitness as a lawyer in other respects. You know, I mentioned that he's unwilling, I guess, or unable to acknowledge or understand, as found by Judge Gonzalez and as found by your referee, that he should have known that his intentional conduct toward Ms. Nilton caused her to reasonably fear harm. And whether you believe that there was intent and malicious stalking, or whether you do not and believe instead that Mr. Netzer was at that time simply incapable of controlling himself or discerning proper and right activities from wrong. You know, either way, no matter what you believe, that reflects adversely upon an attorney's fitness in respects. And the comments to 8.4b, which is the only rule we're looking at here, you know, speak in terms of breach of trust and interference with law and patterns, and those elements are present here. Criminal stalking and violating a court's harassment injunction order, each and both involve a breach of trust and involve serious interference with law. And in Mr. Netzer's case, are part of a pattern of similar concerns. And I would submit that such criminal conduct cannot not reflect on an attorney's fitness. And the referee did make specific findings, and I'm not going to read the referee's report, and those are largely found throughout OLR's brief and in the report, of course. Page 18 contains several of them. Referee found Netzer violated the court's restraining order, and attorneys expected to follow the court's direction, found that Netzer's failure to follow the court order calls into question his trustworthiness. Found that Netzer's continual denial in recognizing the consequences of his actions adversely reflects on his ability to be trustworthy in other respects. The referee's conclusions and findings are not merely based, as I think Mr. Netzer would characterize our argument, on a blind reliance on this exhibit I held up on a judgment of conviction. Your referee made a reasoned analysis of the totality of the circumstances of all of the trial exhibits, the complaints, the prior injunctions, the plea transcript, the colloquy extended as to Mr. Netzer's intent at the time that he was entering a plea, the negotiated statement of plea, which I believe Mr. Netzer attached to his reply brief or one of his briefs, indicating his understanding of the situation. Referee Friedman embraced all of that, as well as the submission of the parties, and made a determination. And his determination that Netzer's conduct violated 8.4b is sound, it is supportable in the record, and it should not be rejected. Mr. Netzer would have you dismiss the case. I would ask you to find a violation. As to discipline, personal conduct that's not related directly to the practice of law has resulted in discipline in prior attorney disciplinary matters, and even personal criminal conduct not related directly to a client, or practice of law, has resulted in discipline under 8.4b. As to the level recommended by the OLR director, he took into account precedent that OLR is aware of prior reprimands, as well as the whole panoply of discipline that's available to you for various levels of seriousness and severity of 8.4b violations. And on the whole, and after applying the ABA standards, initially determined to seek a private reprimand. And when I say applying the ABA standards, the court needs to consider that there are a number of aggravating factors present here. There was you could characterize it as a selfish obsession or a dishonest or selfish motive is what the aggravating standard is. And there's a selfish motive of Mr. Netzer, and there are certainly negative effects of his behavior. There is a pattern of misconduct. Mr. Netzer presents as gentle. I guess I made my own personal observation and recited that to the court, but there's a history which is in the record that he had an incident involving road rage which resulted in a disorderly conduct. There are multiple offenses and a pattern of offenses even within these two criminal convictions. The violation of harassment injunction, I believe, is one incident, but the stalking was a number of incidents as recited in the criminal complaint, again, part of the record. There was not only ignoring court rules, which is an aggravated factor, there's just a direct violation of a court-imposed rule that involved him directly.
Counsel, do you think that he is fit to practice law in the state of Wisconsin?
That is your decision, and I don't know Mr. Netzer well enough, nor did I try the underlying case to develop that level of confidence in opinion. I don't he came up here and has presented his arguments and has complied with procedure, and I don't know why he would not be, in the grand scheme, fit to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. I think that there are some concerns about his behavior. But, boy, if you took all the lawyers that he had concerns about their behavior and their idiosyncrasies, you'd knock out about 18,000 of the 20,000.
Well, don't be so quick to say that. And I noticed you didn't say anything about judges. You confined your remarks to lawyers, so that's a smart thing. What about the diversion programs?
Well, Mr. Netzer suggested toward the conclusion of his brief that perhaps something along – that he be amenable to something along the line of a diversion, and I would refer you directly to the rule, but I'll try to paraphrase it. A diversion doesn't make sense here. Now, first of all, the OLR director looked at the matter and determined that that a diversion would be an insufficient response to the repeated conduct and to the misconduct of Mr. Netzer. So we didn't think a diversion was right. But secondly, a purpose of these diversions, which are made without a finding of misconduct generally, is that they're remedial. They're rehabilitative. And I don't know how you're going to rehabilitate somebody who says, I didn't do anything wrong, I wasn't doing the things that this person said. It's hard to understand how she could show up and say that she was so harmed and upset by all of this as she did at the sentencing. It's hard to understand why the DAs are prosecuting me. Brought up new arguments, at least new to me today. You know, and it was the judge's fault. The circuit court judge should have recused herself, and it was the DA's fault. The DA should have recused himself. Mr. Netzer consistently, to this day, has deflected responsibility and refused to take responsibility. And under those circumstances, a diversion is not likely to assist the attorney. And I think that the wording of the diversion rule, which is like 2210 or so, or 2211, speaks of doing these when it seems appropriate. It's likely to assist the attorney. And so that's why we didn't go this route. This activity, this conduct, and if we had the victim here, I'm sure we'd hear this as well, you know, the people involved with having to deal with and prosecute and adjudge these cases, this would require discipline. And I would submit that it's reprimand-level discipline. And I was discussing some of the aggravating factors, and there's some mitigating factors, and the chief referenced those in her discussion with Mr. Netzer. But take a close look at those. There is no prior discipline. Absolutely true. But, you know, there are prior concerns of a similar nature. There was a self-report. That's absolutely true. But, you know, it came like 8 months after he was charged with 7 criminal counts. It came in June of 2001. He was charged in October of 2000, according to the record.
You're supposed to report on charges or on convictions?
You're required. Actually, I don't know that it was in effect at the time. You're required to report on convictions.
Okay.
And only convictions occurring after a particular date, like July of 2002.
I'm sorry. Charges. Now that I've interrupted you, I'm mitigating. This is a private reprimand, and you've never asked for more. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. With a private reprimand, he can continue to practice law.
Yes.
So not asking for more than a private reprimand, you in effect are saying he can practice law. He's fit to practice law.
We're not thinking that a suspension is necessary to address this particular misconduct. And yes, we're saying that he doesn't need to be removed from the practice of law. Incapacity action, it's a disciplinary action.
Right. And discipline can force him not to practice law. You can suspend him for 3 months, 6 months, or more, but you didn't do that.
Yes.
The referee report suggests that he get counseling. Is that right?
I am not recalling specifically, but it speaks for itself.
It's part of the court order. The judge ordered Mr. Netzer. I apologize to you, to obtain counseling. It was designed to help him understand. Can you, or can the court, I should say, can the court in a private reprimand impose a condition?
Yes, this court can impose conditions on an attorney's continued practice of law. It's within the definition of discipline, which is in Chapter 21, and I'm sorry I don't have the cite at my fingertips, and that can be done in conjunction with a reprimand or a suspension or a reinstatement. You know, Mr. Netzer is active and in good standing, and part of what the referee has indicated is that if it weren't the case that the referee's understanding was he wasn't practicing law, that he would have some serious concerns about even the propriety of a private reprimand. Now, we are not asking for any more than that. That is what we asked for before, and we believe it's fair to continue that request, although there has been more of a development of the all of the circumstances based upon the hearing. I guess that I would conclude with a green light on, no less. And but it's just saying that the conclusion of no misconduct sought by Mr. Netzer, that would be entirely inconsistent with the record and the convictions. It would be entirely contrary to, and I would suggest detrimental to, the public's confidence in, and even the profession's expectation in, the lawyer regulation system and its ability to respond to and address attorney conduct, especially where an attorney violated a direct court order while concurrently committing a crime that caused harm. And that there was harm is recited, unfortunately, but ably by Ms. Nelton in the course of the sentencing transcript, which again is an exhibit before this court. Mr. Netzer's conduct violated the rule, and I would ask you to discipline him as you deem best.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel.
Thank you.
Mr. Netzer, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A large part of, I believe, the reason why the Office of Lawyer Regulation wants a private reprimand or wants a disciplinary action in whatever form, with whatever the outcome, is because there's criminal charges. And that's a big issue for me. As far as accepting responsibility, Mr. Weigel mentioned the road rage instance, and what that was is apparently another gentleman thought that I cut him off. I entered a lane of traffic on Highway 16. I didn't see anybody in front of me. I went into the next parking lot, which was the Quick Trip, and was going to get something to eat. And then I realized there's somebody behind me yelling at me and so forth, and I knocked his hat off. And so, you know, I pled guilty to that. I, you know, take responsibility for my participation in that. I didn't initiate that at all, but, you know, I take responsibility when I feel like I need to. I'm not trying to avoid responsibility at all, but I think that if there were no criminal charges in this case, the OLI would not be bringing this disciplinary action. And I think that my right to counsel is a very basic and fundamental constitutional right that was deprived me initially because on June 14th, I believe it was, of 2000, Judge Gonzalez said, after I had been looking for an attorney, and I've got a letter that I can show the court from John Matuszek. He was one of those attorneys that I talked to, and he indicated to me, after he spent more than an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, sitting in his office talking to me instead of the complimentary half hour that an attorney usually spends, he got on the phone and he talked to the assistant district attorney and he rescheduled some hearings. He went and he got the entire case file, which even at that time was pretty voluminous, and he went over it. And then after a month of him doing those sorts of things, he told me and he told the court that he couldn't take the case. So I go to the court and I ask for a continuance. I need more time to find an attorney. And the judge says, on June 14th, you have until, which is a Thursday, you have until tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock to come up with an attorney to represent you, or on Monday you're going to represent yourself. Well, I just went through a deep depression, and I still wasn't recovered from it. I was in no shape to represent myself, and I certainly wouldn't have been able to gather the documentation and the witnesses that I would need to represent myself on Monday, whereas the state probably would have had no problem with that sort of thing. So I continued to look for attorneys, but I didn't have much time to work with. I got a phone call from the gentleman that ended up representing me that gave me the ineffective counsel. He did not subpoena witnesses. He did not interview witnesses. I asked for him to get court records and to get to file motions to dismiss and so forth. I asked him to get phone records. I think the phone records would have been exculpatory. They would have shown, if he would have phone records from the other party, that none of those calls came from me. So I never gave him authorization to negotiate a plea, but he went ahead and did it. On the Wednesday before the Monday that the trial was scheduled, he comes to me and he tells me, I've got this plea worked out. And so it was not under my authorization that he did that. I know I'm probably sounding a little bit like somebody that is not wanting to take responsibility for anything, but my relationship ended in July. There were no phone calls after that with this person. This person said the relationship ended in May, but I could present evidence. She was at a wedding with me on June 17th. In the middle of June, I drove her and her family to the Minneapolis airport. I have a ticket stub from that. We were still doing things together in June, even though later on she says that our relationship ended in May. When our relationship did end, there was no more contact between me and her. I did not call her up after it was over between the two of us. And so that's why I've been, you know, trying to argue my case about this. When the Court of Appeals handled the case, they said that it didn't matter if Judge Gonzalez didn't find any facts to support these charges. They said that the criminal complaint and the negotiated statement of negotiated plea was sufficient. The statement of negotiated plea, if you look at it, is initialed by several parties without my initials. I did not partake in that as it was finally drafted, but the Court of Appeals relies upon that as being the basis for a factual finding. Also, if they rely on the criminal complaint as a factual finding, the criminal complaint says that 813.1257 was violated. That is a penalty statute. If I had an attorney representing me that was giving me effective counsel, he, I would have thought, would have made an issue of something like that. The Court of Appeals relied on the fact that I was not very seasoned in Court of Appeals policies. I went ahead and I made my request to withdraw the plea, and I asked my attorney to help me out. He refused to help me out on that, to look over the pleadings or to go through the process with me. And I let the time lapse. I refiled the paperwork after I understood what I needed to do. And by that time, a lot of the issues that I was raising, except for the constitutional issues, the court refused to look at, because once argued, it's final. I understand that. But still, what I'm asking you is to rectify that situation. I've went through this. I have been penalized for what has taken place, and whether, you know, you can argue that this is somebody that wants to take responsibility or doesn't want to take responsibility. I have taken one responsibility in one form, you know, whether I agree with it or not. But I just don't think that 20:8.4 applies, because, you know, I have never tried to be dishonest or untrustworthy, and I try to be fit to do my job. So I don't think that applies.
Mr. Metzger, I think the court understands your position and understands that of the OLR as given by Mr. Weigel. And we appreciate your coming and the difficulty of making this argument. And so I will now close this session. And they closed the hearing of 04AP2057D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Randy J. Netzer. And this case is under our advisement, and you will hear the court result.
I just want to apologize to the Chief Justice and all the members of the court that I was going really fast there at the end, but I just wanted to get in as much as I could. I'm sorry.
We understand that, having been before the podium in earlier days, Mr. Netzer. The students may stay. Justice Wilcox will be out momentarily, and the court will reconvene at 1:30 for its third case today. We are in recess.